any of those topics in particular that you'd like to talk about on that list that I've given you? No? I'll get my notes out. Well, we might as well get started. This is Jeff Sturchill. I'm here with Dr. Linus Pauling on the 6th of April, 1987. We're in the Executive Tower Inn in Denver, Colorado at the ACS meeting. Well, let me start.
You don't say Sturchill.
No, it's that's right. If it were Italian, it would, you know, it would be Sturchill. But you've written a number of articles on your early career, and there've certainly been plenty of articles about you. So from that, we know some of the details of your early interest in science. I know you were born in Portland, Oregon, in February 1901, and that you went to Oregon State Agricultural College. But I wonder if you'd talk a little bit more about the origins of your interest in science. Why did you decide to study science at that age?
Well, my father was a druggist, and I used to hang around a little. He died when I was 9 years old, so he can't have had a very great effect on me. When I was 11, I started collecting insects. So far as I can remember, this was spontaneous in that there was no one who suggested to me that I do it. I think I ran across a book about insects which interested me. And there were many insects that one could find in the Willamette Valley. So I made a considerable collection, which I think was left in the basement of the house when my mother died and my two I was in Europe, and my two sisters sold the house. The next year, I became interested in rocks and minerals, mainly minerals. I got books from the library, copied tables out of the books before returning them, books on mineralogy. About the only minerals I could collect were agates. I didn't know enough to find zeolites and didn't have instruments to permit me to identify small crystals. So it was mainly reading about minerals and thinking about them that engrossed my attention for a year. Then in that was when I was 12. That was my first year in high school. When I was 13, my second year, Lloyd Alexander Jeffress, my age, and I were walking home from Washington High School when he asked would I like to come to his room and see some chemical experiments. So we went up to the second floor of his house, which was at about 28th Street. My house was on 40th Street, and so this was about halfway. And he carried out some experiments, which I found just extremely interesting. I think I hadn't thought about the fact that substances can be converted into other substances. Combustion, burning wood in the stove, of course, I just accepted as part of the world. I hadn't thought about the general phenomenon of conversion of one substance to another substance. The science writer in the New York Times has a rather vague idea about this. No, the London Times. Last week in London, I read about a new substance that had surprising magnetic properties. And the science writer, described it by saying it was called BIPO, B-I-P-O. And it was made by taking a yellow substance which exploded to form a black powder. That was all the chemical information that was given. So I began carrying out experiments, starting with a chemistry book that my father had had.
Can you recall what that book was?
I think Williams, but it got lost, left, I guess, when my mother died, and I'm not sure about the Williams. I can remember the book, but not the title page.
Were you using your friend's equipment, or did you start to get your own equipment at that time?
I started getting my own equipment, flasks and beakers. And there was a druggist who had been a friend of my father's, who in Portland there, who gave me chemicals. When I was collecting insects, when I was 11, he gave me some potassium cyanide and some plaster of Paris. I had read about making a killing bottle, so he gave me the potassium cyanide, perhaps 30 grams. And I went home and got a jar, mason jar, and put the potassium cyanide. I went out on the back porch because I knew it was poisonous, and put it in the jar and put some water on the plaster Paris and put that in on top of it, made my killing bottle. So he gave me chemicals and some pieces of apparatus. A man living next door had been a photographer and a guide on Mount Hood and was retired, but was working as the stockroom keeper at North Pacific Dental College. He brought home many pieces of glassware for me, which had been chipped, you know, so that they would have been discarded, and he brought them for me. Then my grandfather was night watchman in the foundry in Oswego. I would go to Oswego on the train, 7 miles, usually every week, Saturday, and come back Sunday. And I could go down with him or without him. Actually, I went to the smelter, which was abandoned, was about a quarter mile away from the foundry. And the smelter was falling down, the wooden structure. The roof of the laboratory had fallen in. There were hundreds of bottles of ore samples and bottles of chemicals. So I would take a suitcase and fill the suitcase with bottles of chemicals, get on the train, take them back to Portland, get on the streetcar, go up 2 miles to my home. For example, a 2.5-liter bottle of sulfuric acid and a similar bottle of nitric acid, hydrochloric acid. The sulfuric acid was black. I suppose it had been opened and a little organic material had fallen in and been dehydrated. A big bottle of potassium permanganate, it's really great to have these chemicals.
So were other friends of yours interested in science at that time, or this is just something that you and...
Well, I saw a good bit of Lloyd Jeffress, but we didn't do any more chemical experiments together. We were together at his home, country home, close by, or at my grandmother's house. He became professor of psychology in the University of Texas and died a few years ago. He was a psychologist, all right. When we were about 15, and he was with me at my grandmother's home, my grandmother said, Liney, what are you going to be when you grow up? And I said, I'm going to be a chemical engineer. And Lloyd said, no, he isn't. He's going to be a professor. I had no expectation of being a professor. I thought I'd be a chemical engineer.
Yeah, you mentioned in one of your articles that at that time you figured that a chemical engineer was the profession that somebody interested in chemistry followed.
That's right.
Why was that?
Well, I didn't have much knowledge about professions. I didn't know about engineering and chemical engineering because I had a cousin, Mervyn Stevenson, who was studying highway engineering at Oregon Agricultural College. And I knew that they taught chemical engineering. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was the profession.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters. One is a year and a half younger, and the other 3 years younger than I. They're both alive.
Were they interested in science at all?
No. The elder, later in life, married Paul Emmett.
Oh.
So I think she had much more contact with Paul Emmett than she had with me. After I went to college at age 16, I didn't see my sisters very much.
Yeah. Oh, well, so she had a secondary interest in science, I suppose you might say. So the fact that your cousin Mervyn Stevenson had been at Oregon Agricultural, Oregon State College, studying engineering is probably an important factor that led you in that direction.
Yes. Well, we didn't have any money. Mm-hmm. Oregon Agricultural College was the only place I could have gone, I think. I rode on my bicycle 2 miles across the east side of Portland to Reed College a few months before I went to OAC. I knew about Reed College and I was sort of interested in it. I drove around the campus. That was all. I didn't go in, didn't see anybody or speak to anybody. But I probably couldn't have gone to Reed because of the tuition, even though I could have lived at home then. But I just didn't know that at the University of Oregon I could have majored in chemistry, or that I could have majored in chemistry at Reed College. But it wasn't too bad to go to Oregon Agricultural College. The main way in which I suffered scientifically, I suppose, is that for 4 years I had no courses in mathematics. Mm-hmm. I took all of the mathematics my freshman year. I'd had 4 years in high school, and 4 years of mathematics, so that I could take sophomore mathematics my freshman year, and then they didn't teach anymore. And I taught full-time for 1 year, which is why I say for 4 years. When I got to CIT, of course, I signed up for many mathematics subjects. For a while, I thought, because of faulty memory, that I had got a minor in mathematics as well as a minor in physics at CIT. Mm-hmm. But in fact, I found my diploma, which said major physical chemistry, or just chemistry perhaps, minor mathematical physics. Oh. They put that down, mm-hmm. mathematical physics.
Do you recall the, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the atmosphere you found when you got to Caltech in 1922. But do you recall the textbooks you were using when you taught quantitative analysis back in Oregon? This was about 1919.
Well, let's see. It was written by a man in the Midwest who then became professor at the University of Washington, Seattle. And I wrote a letter to him complaining about a statement that I said I thought was not true or was misleading. He wrote back. And of course, up until recently, I remembered his name. A few years ago, I talked with people up in Seattle about him, but it slipped my mind now.
Well, What was he? Was he an analytical chemist? Or?
That was quant. Quantitative analysis.
Well, we can. I think we can track that down from the.
Yes.
But was that, from the sound of it, you had, by the time you got to college in Oregon, you already had a fairly good background in traditional methods of chemistry, just from your own investigation.
Well, my junior year in high school, I took chemistry from William V. Green, who I think had a master's degree from Harvard. He was a very good teacher. He had me stay after school hours, 2:30, I think was when high school stopped, and help him to run bond calorimeter measurements of the heat value of oil and coal that was bought by the Portland School District. I think probably largely as a way of giving me a little extra instruction. And when I got my high school transcript, when I left, here I had an extra year, I believe, perhaps only a semester, of high school chemistry. After finishing the 1 year, he allowed me to come in the laboratory and he gave me problems, some organic preparations that I carried out using Remsen. I spilled some sulfuric acid on the book. I think I still have it with pages eaten away by acid. And analytical chemistry, qualitative analysis. I remember this because he gave me an unknown and said that I should remember the words hoi holoi strategoi, hoi holoi strategoi, and tell him when I reported to him. I hadn't started studying Greek yet. About that time I did decide to study Greek and got a Greek book and learned some Greek from it, quite elements of Greek. And so I learned later, hoi holoi strategoi meant all of the soldiers, all the soldiers. He had put all of the metals mm-hmm. into the sample.
Sounds like you were very lucky to come across somebody with that kind of a background in high school.
Yes. I had a one semester course in physics, I think only one semester, with a very good physics teacher, too, a smart fellow. But I was just one of the students in the physics. We used Millikan and Gale as the textbook, elementary physics, high school physics.
Do you recall the other texts you were using when you got to college then?
Granville, differential and integral calculus. At some stage, I used Alexander Smith, general chemistry, or Smith-Kendall, or perhaps even just Alexander. Maybe Smith-Kendall. Kendall was a man who was at Columbia for a while, where Alexander Smith was, and then went back to Scotland. I liked Alexander Smith, big book. I'm not sure I ever had it as a textbook in chemistry. It may be that somebody gave me a copy. In it, I got the word from Alexander Smith's freshman chemistry text. I got the word stochastic. He had, in one of my papers, I quoted several sentences from Alexander Smith, general chemistry.
Well, that must have been an early use of that term.
He Well, I used it. Well, I said that the method that I'm using to find the crystal structure of a substance is a stochastic method, from the Greek stochastikos, apt to divine the truth by conjecture. And Alexander Smith went on to say, you make the stochastic hypothesis, for example, that a substance is a hexahydrate, and then you can immediately test the hypothesis by carrying out an analysis, heating it to remove the water and finding how much water. He may have given a better example than that. I'm confabulating now, I think.
Do you have much, was there much contact in the curriculum while you were in college with physical and theoretical chemistry? Or you mentioned earlier in some of your earlier papers how you stumbled across Lewis and Langmuir in the journals while you were studying. But was that entirely extracurricular?
Yes. I had 1 year of organic chemistry, very simple organic, that's all that I've had. And I've forgotten the name, the writer of the textbook that we used. And a year of physical chemistry with Milner as the textbook. I'm not sure that's right, at MIT. Milner may not be right. I doubt that it is. I'll just try to think. A.A. Noyce had a very poor opinion of the book, so he sent to me and to Paul Emmett in the beginning of the summer of 1922 proof sheets of the first 9 chapters of Noyce and Sherrill, Principles of Chemistry, which then was available in the printed form in the fall. And he asked us to work the problems during the summer, all 9 chapters, in order to make up for the deficiency in our physical chemistry. The physical chemistry book that we used, which was from MIT, as I mentioned, was essentially a cookbook sort of book. That it would give equations without saying clearly where they came from, and you substituted numbers in them. Yeah. It was taught by a man who later got his PhD at Purdue, and he has said that this course was the only course in physical chemistry that he ever gave. And it was hardly his field. He got his PhD at Purdue and remained there all his life and taught chemistry to the football students, he said. It was the football students' course in chemistry that he was in charge of. And when my general chemistry came out, he used it as the textbook. They wouldn't use it in the other courses. They thought it was too hard, but he used it with the football players.
What was his name?
Fred E. Allen. Oh. Fred J. Allen. Mm-hmm. And they have all of the correspondence between Fred and me over the years there at Purdue. Mm-hmm. And some of the letters have been published in Journal of Chemical Education. Correspondence about my idea that we could make xenon fluoride. Mm-hmm. Freddie sent me 200 milliliters of gaseous xenon for the experiment. I wasn't an experimenter. I got Don Yost to try to make it. And he reported that they didn't succeed. He had a nickel apparatus. He couldn't see inside it. And, the man who made the first xenon compounds in one experiment showed a photograph of him holding a glass Pyrex, I guess, or a flask with crystals of xenon. He said he was sure that Freddie, that Yost had made xenon difluoride, but had failed to recognize that he had. I think he may have been measuring the change in pressure, but I don't remember just how the experiment was carried out. So he reported in a paper in JCS that you couldn't make xenon fluoride.
No, it's not the only example of that kind of report.
Someone said that, someone at CIT said that he thought this was about the most unenthusiastic investigator that whoever carried out an investigation. That's, I judge that Don did this just because I asked him to, but perhaps was convinced that it would be a failure.
Well, he missed a big discovery. Well, was it Alan who... one question I was interested in is how you fixed on going to Caltech. Was it just by Noyes' reputation, or did Alan suggest that you might...
No, I don't think that Alan... I don't remember discussing this matter with Alan. He perhaps had got a master's degree already at Purdue. He was about at that stage, a few years older than I. When I was teaching quant full time, the head of the chemistry department, John F. Fulton, John Fulton, I'm not sure about his initial, showed me a poster sent out, a little placard sent out from CIT offering fellowships in chemistry to graduate students. And he said that perhaps in 2 years you ought to go there. Well, what I then did was this. I thought perhaps I ought to go now. Next year for my junior and senior years. So I wrote to A.A. Noyes a letter, and including the statement that I'd have to make my own living, my mother not having any money. And I was giving her the money that I earned that year, too, and the other summers, too. She had a hard time after my father died. So I got a letter back from Stuart Bates saying that A.A. Noyes was not there, and that he pointed out that he thought it would be impossible for me to attend CIT, and which may, yes, it had just taken the name CIT in 1918, I think, to attend CIT and to support myself at the same time. Well, I did it at Oregon State in that when I was a sophomore, when I was a freshman, I worked at odd jobs in the girls' dormitory, the kitchen of the girls' dormitory, chopping wood for the wood stoves and cutting beef, side of beef into steaks and roast. When I was a sophomore, the chemistry department gave me a job in the stockroom, so I got enough money to live on. Freshman year, I had a hard time. Then when I was a junior, the professor of engineering, Sam Graff, gave me a job. I took the course in metallography from him, and he may have given me the job during that first semester of my junior year. It seems to me I worked for 2 years for him, and getting $25 a month for 25 cents an hour for 100 hours a month. And I corrected the papers in the statics and dynamics course, bridge structure, strength of materials, and other things, and helped him in the laboratory. I took the course in metallography, and enjoyed it and began thinking about metals. I had a textbook, for example, we used textbook, I don't remember its name, I'm pretty sure I still have it, that in which they discussed the slip interference theory of hardening, cold work hardening, and the grain boundaries provide the slip interference. Dural, little crystals of magnesium aluminum compound, MgAl2, or a copper, probably the one I mentioned, MgCu2, form and interfere with the slip in the aluminum grains. So, Johnny Fulton, who also loaned me some money, which I paid back after I got to graduate school, Johnny Fulton suggested that I go to CIT. Well, of course, I was interested in Berkeley because of G.N. Lewis and the nature of the chemical bond, and I applied to Berkeley and to CIT and to Illinois and to Harvard. There was a professor of chemical engineering who had got his Ph.D. at Illinois named Floyd E. Rowland. He was an enthusiast about graduate work. He was one of the few people on the faculty at Oregon Agricultural College who had a doctor's degree.
Excuse me a second.